Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is your host, Paul Workus. Today, we're happy to be joined by Dr. Billy Thompson from the Department of Hem-Onc at Primary Children's. Welcome, Billy.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
We've been so excited to have you come on. We've been corresponding a little bit beforehand, and I think this is going to be a very interesting conversation. Tell us a little bit about yourself first. Where are you from originally?
So I grew up in a small corner of Virginia, the southwestern corner of the state, and did all of my undergraduate and medical training in the southeastern United States, which I dearly loved, especially Clemson football. Until about 5 years ago, I hit it out west in the search for something new and much, much taller mountains than we have in the Blue Ridge, and really have fallen in love with Salt Lake City and the Wasatch and the surrounding area. And I have been fortunate enough to call Utah my home ever since.
Well, they're younger mountains, right? They haven't had a chance to get worn down. I think there's a lesson to be learned there that A, it's fun to be around pediatrics, and B, life will wear you down.
Yeah, definitely agree. Yeah.
So you're a Clemson undergrad.
A proud Clemson undergrad who has been amazingly surprised because the Clemson sporting events over the course of the past decade bears no resemblance to what I was used to when I was an undergraduate there when we were struggling to make it to bowl games.
It's been somewhat less struggling lately.
A little bit less, yeah.
Well, we appreciate you being here. We wanted to do some talking in our first segment this month about leukemia. Now, I understand that's one of your special areas of interest.
Sure. I was going to say, I mean, it's easy to fall into that in pediatric oncology since it's far and away the most common cancer that we treat. But leukemia is my primary clinical area of practice at Primary Children's. And yeah, on any given clinic day, gosh, 3/4 of my patients might have leukemia.
And going into our discussion today, are there any conflicts that you should disclose before we talk?
No, sir. No conflicts or disclosures.
Well, let's get started. So leukemia broadly is blood cancer, right? And one of the tough things is, I mean, you oncologists, I think, sort of live in the corner of our nightmares in general pediatric practice because there are a lot of things, a lot of subtle things that families worry about. And the big dark shadow that has them most worried is that they're going to end up meeting you guys. Is that right?
Sure. Totally, totally agree. I think whether it is, gosh, a fever or a large bruise or, gosh, something just hurting in the middle of the night that, you know, you don't really have an explanation for. No, it's not uncommon for whether primary care doctors or families or aunts and uncles to kind of worry, what if it's something scary and more serious? Yeah, and ultimately that's where we come to play. And fortunately, most of those instances where it's not anything more serious, it is just a simple fever or a large bruise because, you know, brother slugged you in the knee or something like that. But yeah, for the small percentage of the time where that's not true, that's where we get to jump into the action.
And I've definitely found as a clinician that as a family is nosing around the diagnosis, sometimes it's very helpful for me to make sure that we understand each other. That's what they're worried about, so they know what I'm looking for and what will make them either have more clarity about what's going on or more commonly to be able to set their worries aside. Now, when we talk about leukemia, we're talking about leukemias, right? There's more than one kind of leukemia. And most commonly?
Sure. So in pediatrics, the most common leukemias by far are going to be acute leukemias, as opposed to some of the chronic leukemias like CML and CLL, which are really diseases of adults. But acute leukemias, and by that we mean something that, not something you were born with, but something that progresses, a blood cancer progresses over the course of months to make you sick and get you progressively sicker until we discover it and start taking care of it, are the most common things we see. The two that we see most commonly, and the differences is really just the kind of white blood cell that is cancerous, is ALL, or acute lymphoblastic leukemia, in which the cancer cancer cell is the lymphocyte, is the most common cancer that we see, treat, and cure in children. Accounts for 25% of all cancer in children. Conversely, acute myeloid leukemia, in which the cancerous blood cell is, you know, some of your myeloid cells, we also see in children, but it only accounts for about 10% of pediatric leukemia.
And what do we know about the cause of leukemia?
Depressingly, not as much as it feels like we should. And that is always a point of frustration for families when we talk to them early on in the treatment course and the diagnosis, as far as why did this happen to my child? And, mm-hmm. You know, what could have been done to prevent it? ALL in particular, like most childhood cancers, we do not know what causes it most of the time. We're gaining more understanding of various cancer predisposition syndromes, but, you know, at best estimate, ALL, that probably only accounts for about like 1% of the causes of it. There's certainly some risk factors like Down syndrome, which increases your risk of both ALL and AML. But in most cases, we do not have a clear, we cannot lay causes, to lay blame as to what caused it for families.
And aside from something like Down syndrome, does it cluster in families? If someone has a cousin who has developed ALL, how concerned should they be?
Sure, that's a good question. And part of that goes to what we don't know right now and what we're learning. So I think if you have a cousin who had ALL, the chances of you having it are exceedingly unlikely. That being said, if you have an identical twin who had ALL, the chances of you having leukemia get progressively more common, and more common the earlier on you are in life. Somebody who is diagnosed with ALL in the first year of life with an identical twin, the chances of the identical twin getting leukemia within the first couple of months after diagnosis are upwards of 90%. And that gets progressively less common, less likely the older you get. So certainly there are genetic risk factors that we're learning more about, but just don't fully understand.
And again, as you say, not a lot of environmental risk factors that we know about.
No, I think that's something that we always try to put to bed and reassure families pretty early on, that from an environmental risk factor exposure standpoint, we can say pretty definitively that it's not where they live, what they ate, anything like that.
And aside from the cell line they come from, what are the main differences between ALL and AML? Or the differences.
Sure. So I think the biggest difference, and this is why when we have a family that's coming in with sort of a new diagnosis of leukemia, we hedge a little bit on establishing expectations about what treatment's going to be like and what to expect until we know for sure the diagnosis. Because I think even though they can present, you know, really kind of indistinguishably from one another, both being blood cancers, the treatments are, you know, really different, with ALL being a longer but a markedly less intense therapy, carrying a much better prognosis than AML, which is a much more abbreviated but a more intense therapy that, you know, unfortunately, even though we've made strides, still carries a worse prognosis.
What about the contrast between the cell line of lymphoblasts? Is there a difference between T-ALL and B-ALL?
Sure. So B-cell and T-cell ALL are the two flavors that acute lymphoblastic leukemia typically comes in. 90% of the children that we see are B lymphocytes as their cancerous cell. About 10% have T lymphocytes. Historically, we thought that there was children with T lymphoblastic leukemia had a significantly worse prognosis. We'll talk more about this later on, but with advances of care and some therapy intensifications, we think it's the difference in prognosis is really kind of balanced out a lot now. But it comes down to us, you know, identifying the right kind of cancers, we can target therapy towards it.
Some people have also talked about there being an overlap diagnosis between ALL and LBL of a lymphoma.
Sure.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so that's totally true. So since the cancerous blood cells are the same, it just depends on where the cancerous blood cells are coming from. In acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the cancerous blood cells are going to be coming primarily from your bone marrow. By definition, you're going to have greater than 25% cancerous blood cells or blasts in your bone marrow, or greater than 1,000 blasts circulating per microliter in your peripheral blood. Lymphoblastic lymphoma, on the other hand, is that when the cancerous blood cells are primarily in your lymph nodes, in your thymus, without significant bone marrow involvement. It is reasonably rare for that to happen for B-cell lymphoblastic lymphoma, which makes sense because most of those cells mature in the bone marrow. Mm-hmm. Conversely, T-cell leukemia, T-cell lymphoblastic lymphoma, when the T-cells mature significantly in the thymus, it's reasonably common to have T-cell lymphoblastic lymphoma, and that accounts for a pretty significant portion of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas that we see in children.
And what's the general prognosis for lymphoblastic lymphoma?
Yeah, good question. So it is very similar to the prognosis for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and the therapies, you know, all essentially identical. Where it comes into play, unfortunately, in the negative aspect, is children. We've got excellent salvage therapies right now for especially B-cell ALL that recurs. For children with lymphoblastic lymphoma that recurs, we've got much worse salvage therapy. So the prognosis after relapse is significantly poor.
So let's get down to brass tacks, because again, the presentation of leukemia is tricky. I mean, so these are things that pediatricians hear all the time. So correct me if I'm wrong. Fever is on the list, right? Pallor's on the list. And somebody's grandma is always worried about how pale he or she looks. Bruising. And in this climate, nosebleeds, right?
I think you're totally right. If you look through the list of the kind of symptoms that they can be present in a patient with new diagnosis leukemia, they are frustratingly vague and nonspecific, and also non-pathognomonic for leukemia. You go through a lot of things. Fever occurs in 50% of patients. Pallor occurs in about 50% of patients. You know, bruising occurs in about 50% of patients. So if you're looking for that one kind of, you know, smoking gun symptom to say, yes, that patient has got leukemia, it's really, really, really hard to find it. I think what really does set this apart is it's symptoms over time. It's symptoms that they do not get better over time, that they that last, that, you know, you've maybe seen, parents have maybe been worried about for a while. Then they go to the pediatrician, you're told it's a virus, you know, once or twice. But when symptoms persist over time, I think that's really when it kind of gets our attention. And I would be more worried about stuff. What you said about grandma recognizing pallor is not uncommon. I think they have a detector more often than not, because the amount of times where when you see your child every day, you do not notice subtle changes. But right. When, you know, grandma or somebody else gets home from a visit and says, oh my goodness, that child is pale. That is the, brings them to our attention more often than you think.
Sure. There's some other less common presentations. Correct me if I'm wrong. Things like testicular swelling can be a presenting sign.
Especially in young men, we know that testicular enlargement it's kind of a sanctuary site where leukemia cells can, you know, dwell and it can actually be tough to reach from chemotherapy. About 1% of children young men will have testicular swelling at diagnosis. That's why we do testicular exams on all of them at diagnosis. That being said, for children, young men with B-cell ALL that recurs, about 10% of them actually have a relapse in testicular involvement at that point in time. That kind of speaks a little bit to that being a sanctuary site where chemotherapy medicines have a harder time getting to. The one other kind of common symptom that I think brings a lot of our patients to attention is bone pain. And mm-hmm. I think that is it's not necessarily unique in children, because certainly children hurt for lots of different reasons. But I think bone pain, particularly severe bone pain, is can be really, really, really prevalent in leukemia. It probably happens in about 50% or so of patients. You know, most commonly, you know, affects, you know, the long bones, can be really debilitating. It can keep people from sleeping, can keep people from walking. You know, if you shoot x-rays, you might see leukemic lines kind of suggesting leukemic infiltrate on there. But bone pain that does not get better in children, especially if there's not a story for why, you know, little Johnny is hurting his back or things like that, is always concerning, maybe a reason to grab a CBC.
Does it tend to be a day and night bone pain?
Yeah, it can be pretty, it can be pretty constant. Waking you up from sleep at night is always really concerning. And even though it's most commonly heard right in the middle of your femur, right in the middle of your humerus or back or something like that, we also see a small percentage of patients every year that they that hurt more in their joints, almost concerning for a more of a JIA kind of picture. And I know that's what keeps our rheumatologists up at night, is those kind of patients being falling into our camp and not theirs.
Well, and you know, again, from a pediatric standpoint, trying to differentiate that from something like, you know, growing pains that are also a real pain and often wake kids up in the night, but are usually completely gone during the day. Would I expect leukemic bony pain to completely resolve during the day?
No, I would expect it to be pretty persistent during the day and progressive as well, from the standpoint of, you know, causing progressive disability as far as child not wanting to play, you know, gosh, walking hunched over, walking with a limp, things like that. You know, so you're this is tough. The symptoms of leukemia are all frustratingly nonspecific.
Okay, so now I've been either following this child long enough and not satisfied with my explanation, or you know, in my experience, sometimes you just look at a kid and this constellation of symptoms doesn't add up. It seems more severe than you expect for, you know, what you usually see coming through the clinic. So I decide I'm going to go ahead and start looking. Where do I start?
So when you have the child that you're worried about that is not getting better, a simple CBC is really a pretty good initial screening test. A normal CBC does not absolutely rule out that this is leukemia or something scary. But more often than not, when patients finally make it to us, they will have, gosh, almost 90% will have some element of anemia. It might not be that your hemoglobin is 3. But about 90% will have hemoglobin below the lower limits of normal for age. And then close to 80% will have thrombocytopenia. And again, kind of the difference between, you know, maybe half of them will have more severe thrombocytopenia, present with bruising, nosebleeds, things like that. But even in a child that you've been following for a while and just has you worried, getting that CBC showing a hemoglobin of 9 and a platelet count of 120, that would kind of worry me a little bit. Your white count, on the other hand, is tougher to rely on. I think, you know, your white count at diagnosis can certainly be, it can be high, it can be low, it can be totally normal. Sometimes, depending on what lab you send it to, you can get clues from the differential. If you've got a really good lab tech who's looking to smear, they might see blast. If you get an automated diff, you might be at the mercy of the counting machine. I had a patient last week that, you know, I looked and turned to her fellow and said, the automated diff came back with 98% lymphocytes on the diff. And I was like, you know what? I'm pretty sure that's not really 98% lymphocytes in the diff. Mm-hmm. So even an automated diff, if the proportions seem out of whack, can they potentially point you in the right direction?
Are there other tests that might be supportive?
The ultimate test that's would be supportive and confirmatory would be a bone marrow aspirate. Obviously, that's not something that you're going to be doing in your clinic. I'm not sure if it's something that we would jump to necessarily if there were not kind of other cytopenias and things like that present. There's things that we always do that I think are important, but as far as absolutely reassuring you or not, LDH and uric acid are pretty unlikely to be abnormal unless you've got a pretty significant burden of disease already that I would expect you to see in some blood cell dyscrasias. And somebody that you are thinking about with having leukemia, and this goes back to what you were commenting earlier about the spectrum of lymphoblastic leukemia versus lymphoblastic lymphoma, getting a chest x-ray and making sure that there is not a big mass in the mediastinum somewhere. Certainly can happen with T-cell ALL as important, but I think those are really kind of ancillary to getting a CBC and really getting it reviewed by, getting a peripheral smear reviewed by a pathologist.
Okay. So, and then at that point, of course, you know, this is where the beauty of subspecialty collaboration comes in. Then we get you on the horn and talk it over. What will you tend to do at that point if it's suggestive of leukemia?
Sure. I think the first thing that we will do is we'll talk it over with you and get a feel for, you know, how is the child doing in that moment? Where are they? How were they when you last looked at them? More often than not, for children with new diagnosis leukemia, you might have sent them to the lab and, you know, got the lab and then they're at home waiting for results. Yeah. And they were in your office earlier today and maybe looked a little puny, but didn't look super ill. So I think in those instances, and especially, you know, with the kind of incredibly broad and catchment area we take care of, I think it's a matter of working with the doctors in the community to, you know, get them to us, but also get them to us safely in a timely fashion that is, respects families and, you know, potentially kind of saves them a 6-hour long ambulance ride from Wyoming if we can avoid it. Mm-hmm. So you triage emergencies, you make sure that somebody doesn't have a mediastinal mass, somebody isn't grossly coagulopathic, somebody doesn't have terrible tumor lysis syndrome, somebody does not have any kind of hyperleukocytosis that's causing respiratory compromise. If you don't see any of those things, then you work to get them to the hospital safely. And that, you know, typically would involve time for families to go home and pack a bag and come see us and, you know, arrange for daycare for siblings or get grandma over to the house and get them down to see us.
And then you, at that point, you're going to do what kind of testing?
Sure. So when we've got a child that we are worried is leukemia, you know, the number one thing that we want to do is to figure out what kind of leukemia it is so that we can, you know the treatment plan and know how to take care of the patient. I mentioned earlier kind of the difference between ALL and AML and how treatment and prognosis is so difficult for families. So normally we can get the kind of leukemia off flow cytometry these days, which typically is done off peripheral blood. If you are in Intermountain and you send a blood sample to the central lab, they might call you and say, hey, we saw some funny cells on here. Are you okay if we send this for flow cytometry? And by looking at protein markers and cell expression, they'll be able to tell us pretty confidently what is the clonal population of cancerous blood cells there as far as, is it B-cell ALL, is it T-cell ALL, is it AML? And knowing that lets us come up with a treatment plan. We almost always plan for the same set of procedures on all patients at diagnosis. We plan for a lumbar puncture to both assess CNS status, look for cancer cells in the spinal fluid, at the same time give intrathecal chemotherapy, which is a very important part of care. We do a bone marrow aspirate typically, even if we do have the diagnosis from peripheral blood, to get additional cytogenetic information about the leukemia, which in the current day and age has become increasingly more important as far as risk stratification and, you know, really individualizing treatment to children, and place a central line to start therapy. And most of our children with ALL, that would be an internalized portacath that, you know, doesn't keep them from swimming and taking baths and things like that during the summer.
What are some of the advances in therapy that have happened over the last few years?
Sure. So there's been a number of advances in leukemia therapy over the course of the past several years. I think with it accounting for 25% of cancers that we see in children, pediatric oncology is really a tremendous machine designed to treat leukemia. And that is every subtype of it, ranging from the favorable risk leukemia that we know has got favorable genetic markers that at this point in time, we would expect, has upwards of a 98%+ chance of a long-term cure. In those children, we've actually been de-escalating therapy over the course of the past several years, giving less intense pulses of vincristine and steroids during maintenance, decreasing therapy for young men who, you know, boys historically had a worse prognosis with leukemia than girls did, to newer advancements. And, you know, I think a lot of these trickle down into the lainstream press and things like that, like CAR T cells, use immunotherapy to help children with relapsed refractory disease. CAR T cells, essentially white blood cells that are collected from the patient and then specifically engineered to target CD19, which is expressed primarily on immature white blood cells, specifically cancer cells, is incredibly efficacious. And then, in the first studies, we'll put, refractory children with leukemia who have had the kitchen sink thrown at them, will get 80% of those children into remission. Previously, what was a pretty hopeless case. And I think, the exciting kind of area that we are right now in utilizing technology like that is figuring out, well, we know it works in children who had a really bad prognosis. Is this a tool that we can, bring up earlier onto therapy to help children who maybe have a slightly worse prognosis or, potentially, offering less intensive immunotherapy instead of traditional cytotoxic therapy.
And you mentioned that the therapy for ALL is less intense, but longer than the therapy for AML. What sort of general length of therapy are we talking about there?
So ALL, and this is, always on families' minds when they come in, therapy is about 2 years and is slightly over 2 years. So it's about 2 years and three to four months. For children with the most common kinds of ALL, they might be in the hospital for the first 4 days of therapy, but then we do not plan for them ever coming into the hospital again. So essentially it's clinic-based outpatient therapy after that. Consists of about 8 months or so of more intense therapy, more weekly clinic visits during that time. It's tougher to go to school on a regular basis just from a clinic schedule standpoint, even if there's times during it where you feel pretty good. And then ends with a long period of maintenance therapy where you're, essentially almost entirely taking oral chemotherapy pills at home. And during that time, hair grows back, you're back into youth sports, going to school. So, ends with about 2/3 of therapy being much less intense for families.
When you talk about long-term survival, what are you talking about?
We have gotten better and better at targeting the right therapy for the right children. So depending on your risk classification, and that goes on age, it goes on your total white blood cell count, it goes on some of the genetic characteristics for your leukemia cells. For children that are young age, so typically between the ages of 1 and 10, have a low white blood cell count at diagnosis, all other favorable factors, it really is. It's upwards of 95%, and honestly, probably even better than that long-term survival. Even children that are older, more teenagers, a lot of times we're still looking at upwards of 85% these days. So it is very much a disease from diagnosis we approach with a lot of hope for taking care of it.
And for that long-term survival, are we talking about decades? Or are we talking about numerous decades?
I mean, we're talking about equivalent to age-matched peers, basically. So, we're talking about, for the child who's diagnosed with ALL at the age of 18 months or something, being something that they're potentially done with by the age of 4, have no memories of therapy, and then, live to 90 years old. And
we're talking about take care of your heart and control your cholesterol because you're going to be using it a long time.
Exactly right. Yes, sir.
Well, that's wonderful. That's a great leap forward. Consequently, there will be some of these patients who graduate from your care and come back to my care. Is there anything I should be particularly mindful about in their long-term care?
Good question. I think that is a growing population of children who finish up leukemia therapy and move back into the general population. Current leukemia therapy has got reasonably few late effects, at least compared to the late effects that you associate with other kinds of therapy like sarcomas or brain tumors and things like that. The most important thing that you can do is really being vigilant for relapse. And if leukemia relapses, the symptoms of it are similar to when leukemia occurs to begin with. That being said, in the context of a family and a pediatrician who is going to be much, much, much more vigilant for any potential bump in the road. So I think all of our off-therapy leukemia patients average a good handful of CBCs a year that just put allow family to sleep well at night.
Sure, sure.
There's a slight concern that some of the intrathecal therapies that children get during chemotherapy can cause some difficulties in school. It hasn't been borne out in any kind of, you know, quantitative deficit in IQ. So other than, you know, excellent anticipatory care and monitoring for a successful childhood, success in school, there is not a lot of additional care that we would recommend.
So we can mainly aim to treat these like their siblings.
Treat them like their children, be aware of their history. A lot of times we do an echocardiogram on them every 5 years or so, but no, the chances of most of these children, especially with ALL, having significant weight effects is pretty unlikely.
Very illuminating. We appreciate your time. For those of you who have questions, send your questions to questions@bcurb.com. We'll look forward to another discussion next week, Billy. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your expertise.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Talk to you next week. Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.